very leading role to play in that.
I know you mentioned that. I've got some specific questions for you.
Oh.
This is a general set. But
well, let me go on and knock off the general set. My understanding of my purpose in, behind the creation of Stony Brook, I've already indicated some understanding of the documents and what I made of them. What was the vision being transformed into reality? Our vision was to create an extraordinarily powerful, singularly powerful state university. That was the department's vision, and that was our purpose. Impressions of Stony Brook when it first came, campus people, leadership, the spirit. Well, of course, it was a tiny, tiny place. Everybody seemed unaccountably cheerful considering what had happened the year before. I don't know whether you agree that the shock seemed to expire fairly rapidly, at least among the people that I hung around with.
You were with a group that wanted to get on with the job of building the university. There was a group that felt, I think, somewhat out in the cold, and had been anti-Lee, pro-Austell and Olson.
Why were they not happy since they succeeded in getting rid of Lee? Why did they not then,
I think,
turn to their agenda? Why didn't we hear more about their agenda?
I think they were, now this is purely my reaction after the fact. I think that the Chicago group was divisionally minded. There were no scientists among them, I don't think.
Well, there were a couple of biologists, I mean, but mainly you're right.
And
there were no scientists, that's right.
And somehow there was enough bitterness left over when I came. And I haven't been in the office more than a couple of weeks. One man came in and said, this place is going to go to the dogs unless you fire that person and that person. And there was enough friction in so that in committees, if one, if a representative of one group made a statement, there was almost sure to be a countervailing statement from a representative of another group, quite irrespective of the value of the two statements.
I didn't really remember that. I guess my committee service was, well, I served fairly steadily on the faculty executive committee or whatever they called it then, but I wasn't on a lot of task-oriented committees.
Well, I had to preside at one or two of them, and for a while, it held us up. But I think people became more and more exasperated at one or two individuals, Nelson in particular. And, we got on with it
for years.
I appreciated the statement that was signed by a group of the faculty. About 70s. Who started that? You know.
I couldn't tell you. I think I remember it.
Remember it?
In fact, I think I have a copy of it in my papers.
I had to deal with representatives of the press who were looking for controversy.
Oh, yeah.
But I think I gradually got Martin Buskin turned around.
No, he became quite a good friend of ours.
Yeah.
Yours, excuse me.
Okay. Executive Vice President, and what's the other title?
Chief Academic Officer.
Chief Academic Officer.
Good. The reason that's not called provost is that, like we did at Stony Brook, we use provost differently here. Mm-hmm. The three campus principal people are called provosts.
I see.
Of the university.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm a central figure, mm-hmm. And they're campus figures.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it's a very poor arrangement because our campus leaders are not recognized appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
They should be called presidents.
Yeah. Right.
And the reason that they're not called presidents is that Blaustein can't be called chancellor because Ted Hollander is chancellor.
Mm-hmm.
And just the minute Ted Hollander moves, I'm going to advocate seizing the chancellorship.
Yeah.
And I will become a vice chancellor.
Okay.
Now, or maybe even a provost, who knows? I should live so long. As to events and persons and experiences that stand out in my mind, maybe that should be the bulk of our discussion.
All right. Why don't we take over this group of questions from there?
My role in the planning and organization of the Department of Physics, well, I was the second chairman. It was a department, I think, actually only for a year or two prior to my coming there. Leonard had no desire to continue in that. He couldn't get out of it fast enough. So they were recruiting for a chairman, and that turned out to be me. There was no plan, nor could there have been one. There was just enough written down to support a proposal for a PhD. There was a very good undergraduate program moving along with some quite good students, quite numerous good students. There had been no thinking about what reach we should be planning for the department. Nor had there been any opportunity to provide for the department's needs, either in terms of physical resources or supporting personnel. You recall how much worry we shared on that issue.
Right.
Nor was there was the department very well plugged into the national research scene.
Right.
National physics.
This is when you came. This
yeah.
is as you found it.
Yeah. There was a little bit of grant support. Nandor Balaj and Jim Raz. But there was an enormous amount of work to do. So we planned and planned and planned. And I must say, by and large, it almost, well, at about the 80% level, it worked out the way we intended. There was, of course, as there was in all departments, an intense amount of recruiting. The department went to meetings in a platoon, and every week we had at least a couple of people in, and we studied them intensely, and the main physical planning, we had some, I had some medium range, shortish range plans that could largely be accommodated in the physics building, the old physics building, metaphysics as it was lately called. I gather it may be called Harriman now. That's a terrible name for it. It's an insult to the great man. That was clearly temporizing. That kept us busy through the. It was possible to believe that the department could develop satisfactorily and be contained in the 65 or 6 or 7 or so without really suffering from disaster. You must remember we didn't get that building until 63. We spent the whole first year with no facilities whatsoever.
Right.
My graduate student had to work in Oyster Bay,
right.
Which was, I have felt guilty about ever since. That was not very good for him, although he did get his PhD.
Was Les Pauldy in physics?
Not at that time. No, he had just graduated.
Okay.
He was my graduate. But the first thing we did was, well, along the way to temporizing and getting up and going, you may recall having to swat me away on various occasions on the importance of finishing the basement and then finishing the attic. And actually, Nelson Rockefeller's bomb shelter was also a historic investment. You recall he hit the panic button in 60. Edward Teller apparently scared the way out of him, and he ordered that bomb shelters be put in all public buildings when they were being built. Physics got one, and chemistry didn't. But by the time 64 or so rolled around, no one was worrying about bomb shelters anymore. The cookies had all rotted. There was someone, Bob Zaffer, I think, found a barrel in the basement about then that was a big industrial-sized barrel that was full of amphetamine. Absolutely full up to the top of amphetamine to give to the troops in case they were worrying about the nuclear disaster. But at any rate, that space, which was some 10 or 12,000 square feet, occurred singularly in the physics building because chemistry was built before, or was planned before physics. And that and our ability to finish off the attic, which was the other project that I then came around and beat your chops to, those were absolutely key because each of them we managed to make sure brought in equipment budgets of the order of $250,000 or so. So long after we, well, the first year we were there, we spent happily planning the expenditure of the order of $1 million for equipment of the old physics building before we moved into it. And that really got us going pretty well. But then the steam runs out of that. So those other little projects kept us perking until the big money began to come. The big, first big piece of the plan, you may recall, was the notion that we should have a major research facility, and we did an analysis and concluded that it should be a tandem Van de Graaff.
Yeah.
And you may recall that kept growing.
I remember that one.
Finally got quite big, and it's still running. It has been a howling success. Young Peter Paul, the current chairman of the department, came in as a pup on that machine and then ran it for several years. And at the crucial time when that generation of machines was beginning to lose its clout with the funding agencies, we came up with a modernization of it, the superconducting linear accelerator, heavy ion accelerator that is now in place. Let me tell you why that worked right now, because I'll forget by now. That was about 1974. And when the competition to upgrade your FM tandem came in the middle 70s, the only way to win it was not to have to ask for a building. The ISF didn't have enough money to fool around with that.
And you had the space.
Tapped a hole in the wall and boom! Just, I must say, I am as proud of that piece of planning as anything I've ever been involved in.
Well, I remember you're asking me to write a letter to Harry Porter about the Van de Graaff, which I did. And then you went down to Princeton and saw something that made you want to get
a bigger one,
the next generation.
Actually, it was down here.
Was it?
It was Rutgers.
I see.
This is exactly the same machine.
I see.
And it cost $600,000 more.
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, I know.
But that was, incidentally, a very, very wise investment.
Yeah. Right.
On the building, the construction fund, that was the most complicated project the construction fund had ever had to do. That was the first really proper research facility that ever touched. A lot of grief over that, but it came out just a splendid building. It cost 50% more than they had made provision for because we didn't tell them it was a three-story building, and they never figured it out.
But you got a grant from the NSF. So
the NSF gave us an absolutely key grant, the first big grant we got. Well, the serious planning of the department began shortly before Toll came. As you may recall, he called for 10-year plans. In fact, he called for them before he arrived.
Before he arrived, right.
And I spent most of that summer in 65 working for the committee you appointed that was chaired by Sheldon. You been talking to Sheldon Ackley?
I haven't. I don't know where he is. I'll have to look.
He's a Unitarian minister in New York City.
Is he really?
Yeah, he's around.
I think I should.
I think, or he's in charge of the Unitarian Fellowship or some such.
All right.
Talk about rumors. There was one that whistled around the campus when he turned up that he was going to be the president.
Oh. Now, Gould suggested that he'd be my assistant.
I remember that rumor, though. But in any case, those plans then became really big league. I mean, we were that was serious planning then, not mid-range, satisficing, which is what we had done prior to that. And that was a lot of fun, and we nailed it together by 66 or 67, and the basic features of the department that we plotted out then, like the ITP and the Stony Brook Radiation Lab and the major expansion of the facilities, the big lab, were all pretty clearly derived from that period when we were talking a 55-member faculty at the least, and we had arguments that it could get bigger. And the main problem in sustaining the growth of the department was keeping the capital coming in some sort of tiered way. The state had this habit of feast or famine that we worked out. Satisfactory arrangements to stretch those funds, so I think that those capital investments were as productive of quality results as one could find anywhere. But that was a lot of fun, and it kept me busy.
You and Johnny worked well together.
He was generally critical of my plans that they were not sufficiently ambitious, so I would take them back and speed them up a bit. But I quickly got over that. He did not have much criticism of our plans. The main features, of course, were the spectacular features were the ITP. And the Stony Brook Radiation Lab, which
IT,
the Institute for Theoretical Physics, France.
Frank there.
Mm-hmm. For the decision of Frank to come to Stony Brook had a major impact on our plans. That made certain. Although, let me assure you, that was planned long before Frank ever heard about Stony Brook. We had that one in the sights. It was clear that the place should always have an extraordinary investment in theoretical physics as long as Brookhaven was there.
Right.
And that just worked very, very well. The harder job, was getting things like high energy going in a institutional environment that had no experience in supporting high-level research. But that went pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And now.
Very well, I'd say.
Could have been better. But it was good.
Yeah.
It was good.
Okay.
Now, the Kemp was department chairman. That didn't exist, so far as I know, in any formal way. It was never authorized by Toll. And as a matter of fact, we spent a good deal of time worrying that it was a vehicle for diverting the responsibility and the authority of deans and some of the vice presidents. I was, as I mentioned, quite active in the governance body, the executive committee, I think it was called then, the faculty executive committee.
Yeah.
But the council of chairman didn't, if my recollection is correct, didn't emerge as an ad hoc body until somewhat into Toll's administration. It was an anti-Toll rallying point.
Oh, really?
And for that reason, we gave it no aid or comfort. By that time, I was in the administration.
Yeah.
And,
that was
Norman and that gang.
Goodman?
Yeah. I enjoyed working with you. I didn't thought you had an extraordinarily difficult task, and I really honestly tried to help.
I think you did.
You did.
You were helpful.
The Toll's name first cropped up at Stony Brook in connection with the dean of the graduate school search. You recall
we had a vacant line, and I felt that.